Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Donc je vais juste vous présenter Morgane Delarue, qui a fait sa thèse à l'Institut Curie. J'ai passé des moments très agréables à discuter avec lui et même faire des calculs avec lui quand il venait dans mon bureau pendant plusieurs années. Après, il a fait un postdoc aux États-Unis, deux même, et maintenant il est chargé de recherche au CNRS, au LAS, qui est le labo de microtechnologie,
analyse architecture des systèmes.
Il m'a dit le plus beau labo de France pour ces choses-là, mais enfin, il est un peu partiel. Donc, mais c'est vrai que c'est quand même un labo magnifique. Et donc, il va nous parler de croissance cellulaire sous pression mécanique.
Ok. Moi, j'ai. Ok, so I'll switch to English, I guess. So hello everyone. So I come from the LAS, indeed. So the LAS, I mean the acronym, it's very complicated. It's basically so complicated that you can do anything in that lab, which is good. But it's mainly biotechnology that we do in the lab. And what I present is also based on macrofluidics development that I present in a few seconds. So what we are interested in is growth under confinement. As Jean-François explained in the introduction, cell proliferation is this coordinated process of growth and division. So cells, they grow, they expand their volume, roughly they double the volume before they divide the volume. And if you take one cell and you let it proliferate, then you will get a cell population. What's often the case when one look at cell proliferation is the fact that they actually proliferate in a spatially confined environment. And that's true for a lot of different examples in the living. That's true for bacteria, for plants, for mammalian cells, for fungi, and I'll come back to that in a few seconds. And if cells proliferate in a confined environment, a necessary condition for them to keep on growing is to push against their surroundings, to push against the cells themselves. And what will happen in that case is that they will develop what we call a growth-induced pressure. That's a necessary condition to grow under confinement. Recently, we've also been interested in multicellular assemblies, multicellular cohesive assemblies. And actually, if you take, for instance, a cell at the center of a ball of cells, a spheroid, I mean, that cell also needs to push against the surroundings and may also experience that type of mechanical stress, even in 3D environment without spatial confinement. So we find examples of that anywhere in the living. We have examples for plants. So here it's the meristem of Arabidopsis thaliana, where the cells, they grow in a planar configuration. And because they grow attached to the bottom, they will start to exert mechanical stress in plane. And that mechanical stress is also growth induced. But if you think of plants, you actually have the roots of trees that grow in the ground. And in the ground, you don't have space to grow. And the roots of trees, actually, they develop enormous amount of mechanical stress such that they can actually break concrete. You also have examples in the case of tumors. Tumors, they grow in a spatially limited environment. And in that spatially limited environment, they will accumulate growth-induced pressure that can be evidenced if you take a bit of that tumor and you see the relaxation of that of these tumor cells inside the tumor. You have examples for the case of microbes, fungi, bacteria. In the case of bacteria, for instance, for meningitis, Neisseria meningitis, these cells, they grow as cohesive assemblies. They can occlude blood vessels. And when cells occlude blood vessels, you have blood clots. And when you have blood clots, then you, again, have a confinement of these cells that will grow there. And we measure the force that these cells develop, and we see that it's enough to actually break a blood vessel. So maybe that's also linked to the break of the blood-brain barrier. So we study in the lab all of these organisms except for plants yet. I would love to work on plants. We don't know how to work on plants yet, but we have the tools. And the way we do it is by engineering macrofluidics cages. Oopsie. And the tools that we have are always the same. All right. So they consist of a macrofluidic cage where we load the cells in the device and we have a valve that can be passively or actively closed. And the chamber is connected on the side to a set of narrow channels. So these channels are too small for the cells to go in, but they are large enough so that we can feed the cells correctly. So here we work at a constant chemical environment. We then design deformable elements, or we just use the deformability of the environment to directly measure the force that the cells develop. So here you have Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the budding yeast, the baker's yeast that you find in a bread, in wine, in beer, anywhere. It's the yeast of life. And it proliferates in this confined environment. And when it reaches confluency, it starts to push everywhere. It pushes on that tweezer here that is deformable, and by exerting pressure, it will deform everywhere, and it will deform that tweezer and then self-close the device. So like that, it will self-confine, and it will build up an enormous amount of pressure that we can measure through the deformation of the PDMS. When I say enormous, it's close to the megapascal range. The PDMS, the material that we use, is the Young modulus is 2 megapascal. And you see a clear deformation of that chamber. So over the years, we have developed a set of different macrophilic devices to confine and study the effect of confinement of organisms ranging from bacteria, E. coli, cerevisiae, but also mammalian cells. Here, for instance, you cannot use directly the deformation of the PDMS, which is not deformable enough, so we developed a suspended membrane that can be pushed by the spheroid, which morphs into some sort of a cuboid in that chamber, and exerts that mechanical stress against that membrane that we can calibrate and then infer the pressure. Before diving into what we study and what we are interested in terms of the response of growth to confinement, I just want to give you two examples also in terms of pathologies that we study. We study another yeast which is called Candida albicans. Candida albicans is a commensal of the gut. It can be found normally growing inside our body. And it is dimorphic. So it has two shapes, the yeast shape, the ovaloid rugby, so it's Toulouse is rugby. So the ovaloid rugby shaped, and it can morph into a filamentous yeast, which is compartmentalized. So here you have different cells, they're just attached to one another. And this hyphal form is the one that is responsible for the pathogenicity of the yeast, because it can go in between epithelial cells and even pierce epithelia. What we have recently found, so we developed a 3-layer device where we have the chamber, these channels so that the cells cannot pass, and here we have another set of channels which are now big enough to let the hyphae pass through, but not the yeast. And what you can appreciate in that movie is that when the cells reach confluent and start to exert mechanical stress, and a very low amount of mechanical stress in the kilopascal range, which is totally compatible with the physiological kilopascal range of our body, we see that the cells morph into this hyphae and invade. And they have this sort of epigenetic switch because they don't revert. Here you don't have mechanical stress, but the hyphae remains a filament. Well, at the end we'd see yeast everywhere, so we don't see, but the filament remains a filament until the end. Another example is antibiotic resistance. Here you have Here you have the baker's yeast. And this baker's yeast, we grow it in the confined chambers. Okay, for some reason the movie doesn't work. Anyways, so we grow the cells in the confined chambers to different amount of mechanical stress, no mechanical stress or a lot of mechanical stress, and then we add that drug, amphotericin B. And we see that under mechanical stress, they start to become resistant of that drug. We don't know why, but this is something that we actually see. Here are the movies. So here, all the cells in blue, they die, and here we see no cell death, basically. Recently, we've also been interested in cancer cells and in confined growth of cancer cells. One key feature that we see in all the organisms so far that we have studied when they grow in confinement is the fact that cell proliferation decreases. So we have less dividing cells, less growing cells. And we thought that that could have a major consequence in the case of chemotherapeutic treatments. Indeed, chemotherapeutic agents, most of them, they target all the cells that do proliferate. So if you add a typical chemotherapeutic agent, for instance, here we used gemcitabine, which is used in the case of pancreatic cancer, it will kill the cells that do proliferate. So if you add that agent on a spheroid that is growing, we see that over time the spheroid is actually being killed, and we see the radius of that spheroid being reduced. If we now confine the spheroid into a hydrogel, so we limit the growth of the spheroid, we do see that it's at the same time it grew much less. You have the same amount of time and you have a radius that is much smaller. And we see that actually inside the spheroid, the cells divide much less, which is why it's smaller. But then when we add the drug works much less as well because you have less target cells. Actually, we can mathematically predict the reduction of the radius just based on the additive effect of the growth reduction and the mechanical stress and the killing of the drug. So we don't need to call for any kind of drug resistance due to some specific gene being activated. It's just the combined effect of a growth reduction and the fact that the drug is supposed to kill proliferating cells, but you have less target cells. So all of that, and again, there's the antibiotic resistance. So all of that, and because we see that in all of the organisms, there's a proliferation reduction, that triggered to us the question of, okay, what could be the cause for this proliferation reduction? So just to be clear, when I talk about proliferation is growth and division. And these two processes are coordinated. And what we see in yeast, and that's a bit less true in bacteria, we see that there's an accumulation of cells in the G1 phase of the cell cycle that Jean-François talked about earlier. So the cells stop at the beginning of the cell cycle. And at the same time, their growth rate, which is the volumetric increase, decreases with increased growth-induced pressure. So that is probably organism-specific because the cell cycle regulation between a bacteria and a bacterium and a mammalian cell has to be somehow different. But we think that the growth reduction can have some similarities between different organisms, and that's what I'm going to talk about now. So the first thing that we have found in yeast, and that's disappointing for what Jean-François just told you, is that the cell volume does not change in our case. So we have measured through 3D reconstruction the single cell volume. So here you have the classical rugby-shaped budding yeast, and here you have its version when it's confined. So it's polygonal, it's the bud is actually squashed at the bottom of the chamber. It doesn't really look like a budding yeast. But we can measure the cell volume, and we found that the cell volume distribution does not fully change. We actually have less big cells, and this is due to the fact that you have less proliferating cells, less dividing cells, and the dividing cells are the big cells. But the small cell volume is the same for all the cells. What's interesting is that if we relax the mechanical stress, then the cell volume increases, and it increases to a predicted value that is associated with the amount of mechanical stress that was built up. So the growth-induced pressure is due to the accumulation of osmolytes inside the cell, and we'll I'll come back to that in a second. And if you relax mechanical stress, the cells they have accumulated osmolytes, and then they swell to the predicted volume that they should have, would they have the space to grow. We can measure cell density inside the cells. Another method that Jean-François did not also discuss is the quantitative phase microscopy to measure refractive index. The idea is that if you have light shining through a sample, you can measure the phase shift and the phase change, due to the difference in refractive index and the height of the sample that the light goes through. Using that, we can measure the refractive index of a budding yeast. For instance, here we found it is 1.38. Okay, it is what it is. And here, for instance, you have a map of this optical path difference inside the yeast. We see the vacuole of the yeast, we see the bud, we see the mother cells. So it works quite nicely. So we can do that under mechanical stress. And what we see is that the refractive index of the cell increases as growth-induced pressure increases. The refractive index is related to, not directly proportional to, but related to the mass, the dry mass inside the cell. So if the refractive index increases in that case, it's probably due to the fact that the dry mass inside the cell increases. So here that's the first signature that even though the volume of the cell doesn't change, the cell is not inactive, it still produces things, it produces osmolytes, that's the growth of the chamber, but it still also produces biomass, and we see it through the increase of the refractive index. So the working model that we have is is the following: how could cell combine biomass production and osmolite production? So as Jean-François explained, the proteins, all the protein complexes inside the cell, they are related to the mass of the cell, but there's not enough of them so that they can provide a large enough osmolic pressure to swell the cell. The osmolites, conversely, they are much smaller, but you have them at a very high concentration, so they are numerous enough so that they can exert a large osmolic pressure. But as Jean-François said as well, what we measure experimentally is that the density inside the cell is roughly constant and it's tightly regulated. It's not very clear still how, but it's tightly regulated. So it means in a way that the biomass and the osmolite concentration should be matched over time. So for a growing cell, we can imagine that the cell produces proteins. These proteins are linked to osmolite production. The cells produce osmolites this way, and that lets water inside the cell. The cell then swells a bit, dilutes everything back to the nominal concentration, and in some sort of a model like that, you can have a constant density. But in our case, the cells are confined. Their volume cannot fully increase. So it means that the cells produce mass, they produce osmolites, but the cell volume cannot increase. So both concentrations should increase in time. Do they increase proportionally or not? That's a question, but they should increase in time. And what we see indeed through the refractive index measurement is that the biomass increases and the osmolite increase is linked to an osmolic pressure increase, which is the growth-induced pressure that we measure in our chambers. So with that in mind, that could have a big consequence in how the cells then work. And this is what I'm going to try to explain. And we think that this is linked to the feedback that we see on growth rate regulation. So this is related to a property of the cytoplasm that's called macromolecular crowding. So the cytoplasm of a cell is highly crowded with macromolecules. Okay, I think I'm just going to do it with a hand. It's highly crowded with macromolecules. So the macromolecules, they're not large enough so that they can exert osmolic stress, but they are big enough so that they can occupy a large fraction of the cytoplasm. For instance, we have measured that in yeast, ribosomes, just ribosomes, occupy about 25% of the cytoplasm, which is a lot, just ribosomes. And there's much more than just ribosomes inside the cell. So that's a picture from the cytoplasm of a bacterium from David Goodsell, but that illustrates the idea that the cytoplasm could be highly crowded. Crowding is an interesting property as it has a large impact on biochemical reactions. As Jean-François reminded, if you increase crowding, you will entropically increase reaction rates by favoring the bound state of two substrata. But at the same time, if crowding increases too much, then the two substrata that are supposed to react then will diffuse much slower, and in that case, the reaction rate will decrease. So theoretically, for any kind of reaction, virtually, there should be an optimal crowding concentration. This optimum can be different for two different types of reactions, of course. It can be more or less pronounced, but theoretically, there should be one for any type of biochemical reactions. So we have developed a tool in order to measure how things move inside the cell, to measure diffusion and not just the density inside the cell, because you can have changes of density that reflect different states of how things move inside the cell. So to us, it was more informative to have how things move inside the cell than just the raw value of intracellular density. So what we designed are genetically encoded multimeric nanoparticles. The idea was to fuse a fluorescent protein onto a scaffolding protein that can self-assemble inside the cell. So here, this monomer, the scaffold plus the fluorescent protein, they are expressed genetically in the cell. We put them onto a low-expressing promoter, and then they will self-assemble, and their size will be guided by the stoichiometry of this multimer. So in the case of that complex, it's 120 mer period. So that means that they will always have the same size. And we have reconstructed the size through a cryo electron microscopy reconstruction, and we have found that they are exactly 41 nanometer in that case. I'll come back to that later, what we can do with these nanoparticles. What's interesting is that this size is roughly the size of the protein complexes inside the cell. You know, this ribosome is roughly 30 nanometer, polymerases, for instance, RNA polymerase is 25 nanometer, the Tau complex is about 40, 50 nanometer. So it's the size of the typical complexes inside the cell. So we can express them in different organisms. We can express them in bacteria, in plants, in yeast, in mammalian cells, even in embryo now. And they look like very bright particles. You have 120 fluorescent protein on one point, so it's very easy to image. And we can track them in time. Whoa. Okay, I'm not sure you see that movie. But you see the trajectories there. So here you have moving particles, but you don't see them. But here you have the trajectories of them. So we can track these nanoparticles. We can extract a wealth of information from this diffusion. And this is something that we are working on, which is understanding this motion, because it's not fairly easy. It's not very Brownian, but it's close to being Brownian. But there's some subtleties that we don't fully understand. But we can anyways measure some diffusion coefficients from these trajectories. And what we have found in yeast, and here you can see the movies, is that, and that's consistent with the fact that density increases, is that the motion of these nanoparticles decreases as pressure increases. And here we can quantify this effective diffusion coefficient at 100 milliseconds, and we see that it's decreasing as pressure increases. Again, if we relax mechanical stress, this, yes?
The diffusion constant doesn't depend on time.
Yes, it does.
For a short time and a long time diffusion constant in a dense system like this.
It's actually decreasing constantly over time. I don't think, I mean, the current models that we have...
Do you measure the R-square as a function of T?
We measure just the R-square at... So we measure at a function of T, but what I plot here is the short time scale. We just average over 20 milliseconds, because indeed it depends on time. To us, it's not fully anomalous in the sense that it's due to some electrostatic or chemical interaction. We think it's steric interaction. So the cell is a fixed volume, so you have confinement because of the boundaries of the cell. And on top of that, you also have large macromolecule complexes inside the cell. They diffuse much smaller, much slower than the particles that we see, so they are effective obstacles to the diffusion. And if you combine the two, then we kind of reproduce the motion, but it's still ongoing. So here, when I say effective diffusion coefficient, is the short time scale, tens of millisecond diffusion coefficient, because indeed it depends on time. And if we relax mechanical stress, then diffusion increases, the cell volume increased, as I said, but it increases to the value it should have had, would it be growing without dilution, without confinement, and we see that because the dilution, the cytoplasm is as diluted as the control in that case. The decrease that we see in diffusion is exponential with mechanical stress, and we can show theoretically that it should be exponential. We can actually even calibrate the slope of that, the critical pressure, the characteristic pressure of that exponential for the 40 nanometer particle that I showed you, and that's here the prediction in black. What's interesting is that the diffusion does not change similarly as the size with the size of the particle that we see. Small particles are much less impacted by an increase of crowding than large particles. Here you have RNA particles that are about 100 nanometer in size and they are super impacted by pressure, whereas the 20 nanometer particles, they are almost not impacted. I come back to the nucleus in a second. We also have measured the locus of a DNA, of a gene inside the DNA, and we see that the motion of DNA, the dynamics of DNA also decreases with this increase of mechanical stress. I'm not showing the data, but we see that actually the nuclear volume is decreased when pressure increases. So just to...
How do you justify the fact that it increases exponentially?
So we combine two equations and one hypothesis. We combine the Doolittle equation that you may know, which relates the diffusion to the packing fraction of a given polymer inside a given, given solution, to the Van 't Hoff equation, and we combine the two, saying that the osmolite concentration is proportional to the mass concentration. If you do that, it should give you an exponential dependence. We can put these nanoparticles in a lot of different compartments, also inside the cell. So I don't know if you're familiar with NLS, it means nuclear localization signal. So we can fuse to this monomer a nuclear localization signal, which means that this monomer will then be imported in a given compartment, here the nucleus, and then the particle will self-assemble inside this compartment. What's interesting is that the NLS, the end part of the protein, is actually hidden, buried inside the donor particle. So then, when the particle is assembled, the NLS cannot interact with the nucleopores. So then you have a nanoparticle that is entrapped in a given compartment, such as the nucleus, and we can measure the diffusion inside the nucleus. We also have them in the reticulum, endoplasmic reticulum. We also have them in mitochondria. So it's very interesting to us because it allows us to measure diffusion coefficient in different subcellular compartments and to also relate how the diffusion, the crowding inside the compartment relates to the crowding of the cytoplasm or different compartments. With these, for instance, we can measure the diffusion of the cytoplasm and of the nucleus as a function of growth-induced pressure. Or also increased hyperosmolic stress. And we see that, so first, surprisingly, the diffusion inside the nucleus for Saccharomyces cerevisiae is the same in the nucleus and in the cytoplasm. I think it's just random because in a Schizosaccharomyces pombei, it's not the case. So I think in that case, it's the case, but I'm not sure it's a general rule. But what's very interesting is the fact that the diffusion decreases the same way in both the nucleus and the cytoplasm, both for growth-induced pressure and anosmolic stress. Okay, so density increases, diffusion decreases. It decreases in different subcellular compartments in the cytoplasm, in the nucleus. The question we then asked was, can that change in diffusion impact some kinetics inside the cell? So the first thing that we wanted to look at is protein production, globally protein production. So we looked at that with optical means. It was hard for us to find a condition to measure properly that parameter because we wanted to use an inducible promoter. The problem is that the typical inducible promoter that you use, like TET-ON, cannot really work in macrophidics because doxycycline or tetracycline, they kind of adsorb to the PDMS, which is complicated. But the second problem is that if you induce a promoter when the cell is still growing, because of the growth-induced pressure being growth-induced, if you don't stop growth, then pressure will keep on increasing, and then it's hard to know at which pressure you measure the fluorescent signal increase. So we decided to starve the cell, because when we starve the cell, then they stop growing. And there's a promoter inside the yeast that's called ADH2 for alcohol dehydrogenase. So basically it switches the consumption of the energy usage of glucose to ethanol in that case to produce energy. And that's turned on by glucose starvation, and we hooked a mCherry to this promoter. So when we glucose starve the cells, the growth-induced pressure is fixed. So we work at fixed pressure and we look at the fluorescence increase in the cells. So that promoter is bimodal, so some cells express it, some others don't, but we are just interested in the cells that do produce that. So what you can observe that in these movies is the fact that the fluorescence intensity increases when we starve the cells, but it increases much faster when the cells are not compressed than when the cells are compressed. These are single-cell fluorescence intensity curves. We can build a very, very simple model of a protein production. In the case of glucose starvation, we can neglect protein degradation because it's mainly turned off, so it's just the production of through transcription and translation, and in that case the fluorescence intensity should increase after a certain lag, which is due to the induction, as the product of the transcription times the translation rate and quadratically in time. These are the fits of the experimental data, and what we call protein production is basically the product of these two rates here. So we don't know what changes here, it's decreasing. But we know that one of the two, or maybe the two, rates decrease. Here you have the quantification, and we see that this production rate does decrease, and dramatically actually, as a function of growth-induced pressure. So protein production is decreasing when growth-induced pressure is increasing and when crowding is increasing inside the cell. But to us, it was hard to relate fully that to the increasing crowding because a lot of things can also happen. So we also use an orthogonal means of changing crowding, which was osmolic stress, to verify that indeed protein production would decrease when you increase crowding. So if you do an osmolic stress to the cell will shrink, crowding will increase, and that's almost instantaneous. There's a lot of osmoadaptative pathways inside the cell. In the yeast, there's only one that's fairly easy. It's HOG1. So if you do a knockout of that protein, then you have no osmoadaptation. That's why yeasts are cool in that sense. So in that case, we kill osmoadaptation and the cells will remain shrunk for a very long period of time. So they will remain at very high crowding. So we used exactly the same reporter. And we have found that indeed the protein production rate decreases when you increase concentration of the osmolite. Yes?
Question, this osmoadaptation is supposed to produce something to make the cell.
Yes.
So this shouldn't change the pressure inside the cell. It should keep high even though it's osmotically adapting its volume, is that right?
Yes.
So if you don't kill HOG1, what happens to the expression rate?
So if we don't kill HOG1, what happens is that, so if it's a, let's say a large osmolic stress like these two guys, HOG1 is a transcription factor. It goes inside the nucleus and it produces proteins that produce more glycerol in order to accelerate the production of glycerol, which is the main osmolite in the yeasts. But if you don't, then you remain with the housekeeping production of osmolites, which is too slow to compensate in that case.
But here, the expression rate is of your reporter.
Yes,
so
correct.
Does this change with the osmoadaptation, does this manage to change the expression rate?
So if we do exactly the same experiment.
Right.
So the difficulty here is that when you do an osmolic stress and you have HOG, it's also triggering some transcription shutdown for a lot of different genes, and that we have measured at a single cell level. The problem then is that this gene is not turned on. So we cannot fully do the experiment in that case. So it's not perfect, I agree. So there's still a lot of assumptions. What we can then do with this data is plot this expression rate of the reporter as a function of the diffusion that we can measure in the different conditions, osmotic and growth-induced. Because then here we have two metrics that we can measure independently for the two types of mechanical stress. And what we see is that they kind of follow exactly the same relation where the expression rate decreases as the diffusion decreases. It's not proportional. Actually, if you have diffusion-limited reaction in our case, where the rate should be proportional to diffusion. The big question is the diffusion of what? And in our case, what we can see through the change of diffusion with the size of the particle is that if we plot that as a function of the diffusion of 40 nanometer, it should scale as a power law of the diffusion of something of a given size. So if we fit that power law, the exponent is actually the ratio of the size of what's limiting to the size of the 40 nanometer. And in that case, we find that what's limiting is in the range of the 100 nanometer. Okay, then we know that, but it doesn't tell us a lot. Maybe you also have a combination of different processes that are limiting. So with all of that, we wanted to build a model of a normal and confined growth. The idea of that model is, so that's basically summarizing everything that I've told you. The idea of that model is to say that macromolecules, they produce for themselves. Think of ribosomes producing ribosomal proteins. It's often the model that is used to explain exponential growth. And these proteins, they can also produce osmolites. What we enforce in the model is that the rate of osmolite production is proportional to the rate of macromolecule production. And we also enforce that they have the same feedback with crowding. So that is something that we can debate, but it's what we enforce in the model. So Because you have more molecules that's crowding the cytoplasm, and what we have seen is that this increased crowding will negatively feedback onto protein production, decreasing it. And osmolytes, they will lead to water influx that will lead to cell growth, which dilutes the cell and then negatively feedbacks onto crowding by diluting the cytoplasm. Okay? So now if the cells are confined, it's, in our case, as if they are growing against an effective elastic modulus, which is the combination of the elasticity of the surrounding cells and the PDMS gauge that the cells are around. So growth will lead to that growth-induced pressure, which will also elastically limit the production of growth. So we can parameterize all of that model. There were 8 parameters, if I remember correctly, and some of these parameters took us years. But the good thing is that with that parameterization, we can predict how the model works. And it works actually very well. And here you can see the prediction of the model. So this is just enforced. But here you see how the growth rate should change as a function of pressure, how the growth-induced pressure should change with time, and how cell number should also scale with time. So that's a prediction of the model. Because this is a model that's fully calibrated, we can relax one hypothesis. And the one that we wanted to relax is actually that one. What happens if we kill the feedback of crowding onto macromolecule biogenesis? And if we do that, then, okay, protein production doesn't change with pressure. Growth rate still decreases a bit, and that's due to the fact that you limit growth in this elastic cage. So that was expected. But what we see is the magnitude of change. So most of the growth decay is actually explained by the feedback of crowding onto macromolecule biogenesis and not the mechanical limitation of the cage. And we see that pressure shoots up very fast, and also the cell number is then not as limited and increases very, very fast. So I'm almost done. I just have two more things to say. The first question I want to ask is, okay, can that be universal? As I told you in the beginning, what we see is that in every studied organisms, we see a decrease in cell proliferation. We see that in bacteria, in mammalian cells, and in fungi. So do we also see in these different organisms a change in crowding, a change in growth rate, a change in protein production, etc.? So here, I'm not going to show you all the data. I'm just going to show you two pieces of data for E. coli. What we see is that crowding indeed increases when the cells are confined, and growth rate is also decreasing roughly exponentially when the cells are confined. We also see that protein production decreases roughly exponentially when the cells are confined. So everything that I told you in yeast seems to be true in E. coli. Okay. The second thing is in mammalian cells. So in mammalian cells, we are much less advanced in our data. What we see, though, very recently, is that what we have seen, though, is that the diffusion of these nanoparticles also decreases with increased mechanical stress. So if you confine a multicellular spheroid, pressure increases, and the diffusion also decreases in that multicellular spheroid. Just as a side note, because this is intriguing to us, what we see is that inside a freely growing multicellular spheroid, we feel like we have the same thing happening. We see that as you go from the border of the spheroid towards the center of the spheroid, there's a decrease in diffusion, intracellular diffusion. So the cells become more and more crowded as you go towards the center. And this is related also to the fact that you have less and less dividing cells. We just wonder if what we have seen in a confined case could also be true in a non-confined case through the similar origin. I'm just raising the question. I don't know if that's the case because there's so much more interactions that can happen in that case. So if you look at the growth-induced pressure curves that we measure for all of the different organisms, we see that in all the three cases, they are concave. The fact that they're concave is related to the fact that the growth rate decreases with increased pressure. So because the growth-induced pressure is growth-related, as time increases, growth-induced pressure increases and growth rate decreases, and that leads to that concave shape. If we assume in all organisms that the growth rate decreases exponentially with mechanical stress, then we can predict that the pressure should rise logarithmically in time, with a typical time that would be related notably to the division time of the organism, and a typical pressure that will be related notably to the typical toggle pressure of the organism. So we can fit all of these curves with that model, extract all of these different parameters, and then plot these different curves in a normalized pressure versus normalized time plot. And here you see that all the curves seem to superimpose very, very nicely, suggesting maybe that similar regulation of growth through maybe crowding increase could lead to that exponential decrease of growth, leading to that logarithmic increase of pressure over time. Okay, the last thing I want to tell you is that I've been roughly lying to you, because in all the talk I've been talking of what's happening in that region of this plot here, assuming that all the cells, they mainly sit at their maximum crowding concentration, and if you increase pressure, if pressure increases, sorry, crowding increases, so you will necessarily go there. But what if you start with a cell that actually is less crowded than the wild type? In that case, what we should expect is that rates should increase with pressure and not decrease in that case. So we have found a mutant in yeasts again. It's called SFP1. For those who know cancer, this is a CIMIC orthologue. So CIMIC is a very nasty one. It's mutated in most of the tumors. What we have measured for both the wild type and this mutant is the fact that indeed this mutant, which is implicated in a ribosome biogenesis, it has a much lower product growth rate. And the explanation that you find in the literature for this decrease in growth rate is the fact that it has less ribosomes. So it has less ribosomes, so it's growing less. Okay, why not? The second thing that we have measured is the fact that diffusion is larger in that mutant. And again, we can explain that maybe with less ribosome, less biomass inside the cytoplasm, so more diluted cytoplasm. But when you increase pressure, crowding still increases. Not exactly at the same rate, but it still increases. So everything that I've been telling you about the fact that as pressure increases, crowding increases, this is still true. But what may not be true is how growth rate changes in that case. And the big surprise was actually there. So we did the experiment 12 times because it was very puzzling to us at the beginning. So here what you see is the growth rate of the wild type as a function of pressure, and that's decreasing, that's what I've been telling you. But what you see in blue is the growth rate of this mutant, and it's actually increasing as a function of time, and not decreasing as a function of time. And actually, there can be a nice and easy reason for that. I mean, easy, quote unquote, easy. If you plot now growth rate as a function of diffusion, so you just get rid of pressure, what you end up with is a plot like that. So here, pressure goes in that direction. So it's the difference. It's different from crowding concentration because it's diffusion. So when concentration increases, diffusion decreases. So if you plot growth rate as a function of diffusion, you see that for these two guys, here you have the mutant. So it's starting at as a lower growth rate and lower and a higher diffusion, and it goes in that direction when pressure increases. Whereas the wild type, it seems to be sitting at the sort of maximum of this bell-shaped curve, and then it's decreasing when the growth rate increases. So for now, we just have two mutants. We actually found a third one that should be. So the thing is that we cannot go to higher pressure because then we start to have a nutrient effect where the cell starts to be starved, and that's not good. But we have found a mutant that starts there. So our hope is that we can maybe see first an increase and then a decrease to see how that could work for different mutants. But to us, that's very interesting because it means that indeed there can be some sort of optimum for the cells. So I'm not sure that the wild type sits at the maximum. I think it's actually the other way around. We have optimized the growth conditions so that the wild type is growing at the maximum rate. Because, I mean, the growth media that we have, they've been optimized for decades and decades and decades, and they have been optimized to maximize growth mainly. So maybe that's why the the wild type sits there. But then if you use the same medium for everyone, this is the kind of curve that we find. So to finish, I have a game for you. Ah, okay, so you don't see nicely the colors. I think that will work still. So here we start 50-50. Mutant cells in red, wild type in green. They will be confined, there will be buildup of pressure. Question, who wins? So the green, the wild type. Okay. And the mutant? Okay. The answer is, I'm from Normandy. Normandy, we always say, okay, that depends. That depends. That depends because here you start, there's no pressure. When there's no pressure, the wild type proliferates much faster. And then there's pressure. So at the beginning, the wild type overtakes the population. And then pressure builds up, and then poof, the mutant takes up. Because then the mutant has a much larger proliferation rate than the wild types, which keeps on decreasing. So to us, that's a very, so it's yeast, I know it's not mammalian cells, but to us, it's a very interesting experiment because if you think of a tumor case, there's always different clones appearing at the given time, but they don't appear at zero mechanical stress or zero given chemical environment. They appear as the tumor evolves. And maybe some of the mutants that occur in a tumor setting can also emerge when the tumor is confined and experiencing a bit of mechanical stress. And maybe they do emerge at that time because it gives them a proliferating advantage when the cell is confined. But when we study it without confinement, we don't really see that. We just see a decrease in proliferation, right? Not necessarily the increase that we would see in the case of that tumor setting. All right, so that's it for me. To summarize, I'm not saying that there's no biology. So I'm a physicist, but I acknowledge a lot the biology. I'm just saying that any type of mechanical stress or stress that you do, chemical or mechanical, it will have two consequences. It will have some physical modifications of the cell, of the membrane tension, but also of the crowding inside the cell, in the cytoplasm, in the nucleus, maybe in other different compartments. And the physical modification that can trigger some physical changes that can affect a given response. But that can also trigger maybe some interaction with the biological integration that will also occur. We have found that in that case, there's also a lot of different pathways that are turned on. I'm not neglecting that, and there are many turned on also to regulate cell division, which I haven't talked about. But the fact that cell division will also be impacted by the change of these physical modifications. Basically, that's the point. All right, thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.